Alrighty. Recently, I saw a woman with Alzheimer's, and she really wasn't in a position to take any of my recommendations because she basically came to me saying, well, I'm already taking supplements, there's nothing left for me to do, and so I gave her some precise recommendations, and it just didn't work out. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read something to you. Let me see if I can get on my phone real quick here. Oh, the book that I have in front of me, Dale E. Bredesen, M.D. He's a professor and founding president of the Buck Institute, and he's a professor at UCLA. He's written a book called The End of Alzheimer's, but in the preface of his book, actually, maybe that's Dr. Perlmutter that wrote the preface. Let's check and see real quick. No, anyway. I was, to me, this was very, very interesting. And he was saying that if you want to contact the Food and Drug Administration and see if they're approving any new Alzheimer's drugs, well, they've had in the last, let me see, from the year 2000 to 2010, there have been 244 experimental Alzheimer's drugs tested over that 10-year period. And exactly one, memantine, was approved in 2003. And, of course, Dr. Bredesen is saying it really doesn't even work. So does that kind of give you a template for where we're maybe going to go today? Now, what I want to do is I want to read this to you. I find this very, very interesting, and I'll see if I can find my article I had on my phone. All right, this comes from Dr. Frank Schallenberger, M.D., and it's about sugar and Alzheimer's. So just, this is only one point. I'm not trying to make one thing fit every situation. It goes on to say that studies have shown that sugar and high-carbohydrate foods cause an increase in blood sugar. You knew that, though. Which, in turn, increases the risk of dementia. This is particularly true of the risk for dementia due to Alzheimer's disease. Because of this connection, researchers began to study how high blood sugar contributes to the development of Alzheimer's disease. They examined a group of mice that were genetically prone to Alzheimer's, and they fed them enough high-carbohydrate foods to raise their blood sugar levels. Then they measured levels of amyloid plaque, which is a substance that contributes to the destruction of brain cells, and blood sugar in the hippocampus region of their brains, the region that controls memory. The amount of amyloid plaque that developed in the hippocampus of these mice directly increased as their blood sugar levels increased. Isn't that interesting? The effect was even greater in the older mice that had already showed early signs of Alzheimer's, indicating that a high carbohydrate meals not only contribute to Alzheimer's, but they also worsen the disease. Eating foods high in carbohydrates increases the likelihood of developing Alzheimer's disease later in life. Foods high in carbohydrates, such as grains and sugars, cause a significant rise in blood sugar levels. Decreasing high carbohydrate intake will decrease risk of weight gain, diabetes, heart disease, and the progression of Alzheimer's. Now, this, I don't know if it's going to blow your mind. Maybe it can only blow your mind if you have a mind to blow. But the writing is on the wall. We're headed toward a nation completely covered up with Alzheimer's. And this comes from Bill Sardi. Seemingly out of nowhere, researchers in Asia, they jump from the confines of the animal lab to applied human therapy. Five early-stage Alzheimer's subjects were given 300 milligrams daily of vitamin B1. Now, the form that they were given was the benfotiamine, which is a fat-soluble form of B1. It's kind of important. And they gave it to them for 18 months. And then they subjected them to PET scans. Do you know what a PET scan is? What is that called? Positive emission tomography? Anyway. So they were going on to say that they subjected these people that took the fat soluble form of vitamin B1 for 18 months, and then they measured them with PET scans and they gave them mental function tests. Hey, I already like this. Simple test. They're giving them a vitamin and they're coming back and they're seeing how their brain works. I like it. They go on to say that the common form of vitamin B1, which is thiamine HCl, that's just a synthetic vitamin. It's not really found in nature. That's man's idea that we can do as good as God has done. That's not true. The common form of B1 provided in multiple vitamins does not produce this beneficial effect. Now, he goes on to say, from these 5 test cases of Alzheimer's, despite the progressive accumulation of beta amyloid deposits in their brains over the duration of the study, researchers remarkably found the progression of brain dysfunction can be halted and even improved. Wow, I'd like to see a drug do that. They go on to say that mental function tests improved among these patients with early to mid-stage Alzheimer's disease. And the brain scans reveal, on average, 36.7% of the brain was reactivated. Now you tell me, would you prefer to lose about 37% of your brain function, or would you like to reactivate your brain, meaning you have regained about 37% of it? It says, this startling and compelling report was published in the journal Neuroscience Bulletin in December of 2016, just in case you want to look it up. And Bill Sardi goes on to say that the news media did not cover this. Imagine these images on the front page of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And the images I'm looking at are color positive emission tomography scans, or PET scans. It says the value of 125 developmental drug companies and many other major pharmaceutical companies would plummet their values in Wall Street in one day if they saw this, because there's no drug that can do this. It is no wonder that Alzheimer's disease poses a challenge to a carbohydrate-craving society. So do you remember the article I just read to you from Frank Schellenberger? The more carbohydrates you consume, the more you deplete your body of B1. Another way of saying it, this is, carbohydrates automatically increase the need for B1. This is why Dr. Derek Longsdale, the reigning vitamin B1 expert in the world, says, we live in a modern era of high-calorie malnutrition. What are you going to do if your brain is starving for B1? Going to eat more carbs? No, it's going to deplete you. You can't see what I'm looking at here, but I'm looking at brain scans. It's just phenomenal, folks. Anyway, that's one point. Here's another point right here that I found was interesting. All right. One of the most important recent findings is that sleep is essentially like bringing in the overnight cleaning crew to clear the toxic waste proteins that accumulate between the brain cells during the day. Now, this is the research of Dr. Macon Niedergaard, a co-director of the Center of Transitional Neuromedicine at the University of Rochester. And she has studied the mechanism underlining these cleaning functions. And I'm just quoting her. It's like a dishwasher, she said. Just as we wouldn't eat off dirty dishes, why should we settle for going through the day with anything less than the full power and potential of our brains? She's trying to say, what if your brains are dirty? I don't know if you've ever heard of the disease called beriberi before. I think beriberi comes from Swahili, which means I can't. And some of the stories that I've read, a person with beriberi, which is a severe vitamin B1 deficiency, they could attempt to walk across the city square and they may collapse. And there may be cars coming. And they could be laying in the road and a car could run over them. And they would say, I can't get up and move. I remember one story I read about a guy named Nick Rowe. He developed beriberi, and he had just had incredible fluid all over his body. Now, I know this would be a subtle sign, but what if you have some degree of fluid retention? Well, it sure is worthy of trying to correct that. What Dr. Niedergaard's research on mice revealed is that we have the system that's called the glymphatic system. It's essentially the brain's plumbing system, and it functions at a much higher rate during sleep and plays a critical role in brain maintenance. In her study, as the mice slept, their brain cells actually shrank in size, creating more space for the spinal cord and the brain fluid to flow throughout the brain. And they literally swept away the toxic buildup associated with Alzheimer's. Initial studies have shown that a similar process may occur in the human brain, a fact that could provide a major step forward in the prevention and treatment of dementia. This washing away of waste chemicals and toxins happens only when we sleep. When we're awake, the brain is too busy handling our body's many functions. As Dr. Niedergaard put it, and I'm quoting her, "The brain only has a limited amount of energy at its disposal, and it appears that it must choose between two different functional states. Either you're awake and aware, or you're asleep and cleaning up. You can think of it like having a house party. You can either entertain the guests or clean up the house, but you can't really do both at the same time. The consequences of not giving your brain this needed time to wash away toxins and waste chemicals go far beyond simple maintenance." Oh boy. According to Claire Sexton at the Oxford Center for Functional Magnetic Resonance Imaging of the brain, a lack of sleep over time is associated with a decline in the size of the brain itself. "We found," and I'm quoting her, "that poor sleep quality was associated with an increased rate of decline in the brain volumes over 3 to 5 years. Folks, if you want to develop Alzheimer's, there's only a few things you have to do. Number one, you just have to eat a high carbohydrate diet. And so you tell me, every fast food restaurant that you go to, what is everything based on? It's based on carbohydrates. That's what's cheap. That's what's easier to provide. That's what fills people up. You know, if I could come up with a solution to provide bread at every meal, I think I could be the most successful physician on earth. But I can't do that. So if you eat a lot of carbohydrates, that is what you're looking at." I was reading an article yesterday, and it was talking about the relationship between human growth hormone. And one of the books that I looked at on Amazon, they call it the Methuselah factor. Now, what do you think that means when they reference human growth hormone as the Methuselah factor? Well, isn't it recorded back early in the book of Genesis that Methuselah had lived on earth as far as accounted years longer than any other human had? 969? Did you know, though, that every time sugar is above 100, you're suppressing human growth hormone? Yeah, that's my diabolical plot for you. If we can find a way to get your blood sugar lower, then you can actually start to have more human growth hormone. And the last time I checked, human growth hormone's what you want. If you can train your body on a lower carbohydrate diet to increase human growth hormone, that's called healing, 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 repair, 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 rejuvenation, vitality, becoming younger, not aging so rapidly. So here we are. We're kind of stuck in a pickle here. So what do you do if you insist on a high carbohydrate diet? And I understand. I mean, sugar is very addictive. And sometimes that's the problem with wheat, because it has such a high amount of amylopectin, which is a starch that rapidly converts into sugar, almost worse than sugar. So you have all these dietary factors that just generate horrible amounts of inflammation, but you don't understand that all the sugar and all the grains are what is driving that. Well, maybe now you do. So what are you left with? You're left with eating vegetables that are lower in starches and carbohydrates. And you're left with good healthy proteins and good fats. But the other issue is sleep. unless you sleep at night, your brain cannot clean itself and remove the debris and the toxins and the plaque that builds up. And so, yes, it's a very interesting phenomenon that if a person wants to heal, but they want to go to bed at 1 o'clock in the morning and 2 o'clock in the morning and 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock, it just makes it very, very difficult to see tremendous improvement. Because if you miss that golden window of opportunity between about 12 and 1 o'clock in the morning, I mean between 10 and 1 o'clock in the morning, where you have this natural rhythmic surge of human growth hormone, that's not the only time, but it's just one of the times, it's kind of hardwired into us, then what have you got? Well, you've got a mess on your hands. So, do you want to put all your stock in a new drug that could be coming out? There's already 244 drugs from the year 2000 to the year 2010, and they've completely failed. But these drugs all showed a tremendous promise, at least with one or two models, but they failed to work in real-life human beings. So you tell me, is medicine going to come up with a vaccine or a cure for Alzheimer's, or is it because the very things that we are doing to ourselves? I'll let you answer that question. The phone number here at the station. This program, if you haven't heard it before, is called Health Essentials. I'm your host, Dr. Roy Morgan. It's good to be with you, and I just looked at the clock. We're already 16 minutes into the program. I just figured it was 5 or 6. If you want to join me on the radio and ask a question, or if you're puzzled by something, please run it past me. Let me know what the symptoms are. Maybe there is a clue in what you're telling me that can help me understand maybe what's not working right with your body. But the number here is 903-586-5257. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, sir. I had a question about this book that you recommended that I read, Dr. Norman Doening.
Doige.
Brain's Way of Healing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm starting to get into what this guy was talking about. From South Africa.
Right, good.
But I'm also having a problem with my PSA going up. I'm at like 608. Okay. And I'm wondering what I could do to get that thing pulled down.
What do you eat breakfast every day?
Pretty much.
What did you have for breakfast? Or what will you have? I know this is too early for breakfast probably.
I usually try for scrambled eggs and butter.
Okay. I don't think you can go wrong with that. This book that I'm referring to this morning is written by a guy by the name of Dr. Dale Bredesen, and it's called The End of Alzheimer's. And in that book, he details about the 37 different pathways that contribute to a loss of brain function. So if your PSA is going up, there's several things that you can try. Number one, you've got to lower your intake of carbohydrates. That may be one way of using maybe what's called a cyclical ketogenic type diet. Because you're literally trying to starve the prostate cells of anything that would be driving inflammation toward prostate cancer. Now, do you have any diagnosis of prostate cancer?
Not at this time.
Do you have an infection? Because that can make your PSA go up also.
That's unknown.
If you go to the doctor and they do a lab test, I'm just looking for a white blood cell, and this is for chronic infections. So if you have a chronic low-grade infection somewhere in the body, like in the prostate, your white blood cell count's usually going to be 5.6 or below. And there's plenty of studies that demonstrate that if a person routinely goes for a lab test and they do a white blood cell count and it comes in at 5.6 or lower, like 4.5 or 3.5, one of the things you're dealing with is the potential for a chronic low-grade infection. And I'm not going to tell you how I got in trouble about 20-something years ago, but let's just say it revolved around men that had high PSAs. And when we cultured their prostate fluid at the laboratory, every one of these cases had infection. And so that's really, really easy for me to buy into. So if you have a high PSA, there's probably your white blood cell count's going to come in probably low, and that would give me a clue that probably your prostate is harboring some type of a low-grade infection.
Sounds reasonable.
So you can at least cross-reference your blood work and see if there's any correlation.
Okay, I can do that.
Okay.
Any other suggestions?
Well, the number one thing that I would do if I had a high PSA is I would make it very easy for those natural, normal cells in the prostate to come back to life again. And one of the ways you can do that is by, let me just say it this way without going into too much detail. Start your day with a forkful of Bubby sauerkraut. I would probably do a highly restricted carbohydrate diet, meaning I would eat things like eggs and fish and probably chicken and even grass-fed beef. But I would totally lay off any grains. I wouldn't eat any fruit at all, none. And I would just eat low-starch carbohydrates or low carbohydrate vegetables, and that's going to be things like turnip greens and broccoli and cabbage and cauliflower and Brussels sprouts, almost any greens that you can think of, cucumbers, asparagus, yellow squash, zucchini squash, all that's good for you. I would just lay off the ones that are heavy, heavy duty sugar, like bananas and mangoes and dried fruit, stuff like that.
How about olives?
Olives are usually just fine.
Okay, Doc.
Are you going to ask me about anchovies also?
Oh, I'm not.
But if you would look into that, all you can do is go back and see if your PSA goes down. But I would just request that you look at your blood work and see what your white blood cell count is. And if it's 5.6 or below, then I have the strongest bend toward you have a chronic low-grade infection somewhere in the body. It doesn't have to be in the prostate. And that's one of the reasons why... Sometimes I'll use garlic, echinacea, and golden seal just for a short season to see if that PSA level will go down. Now, your doctor, he might recommend you take an antibiotic to see if the PSA will go down. Has he done that?
No.
Do they have any recommendations for you?
Not yet.
This is just they kind of called you and told you the results, and you're going to go visit with the doctor later, right?
Pretty much.
Okay. Well, I wish you the very best.
Okay, Doc. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye. Oh, boy. Okay. If you want to call me on the radio, there's a phone line open, 903-586-5257. 586-5257. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Hey, quick question. What foods do you eat to increase the natural B1 if the synthetic B1 isn't doing it for the body?
The number one source is calf liver.
Calf liver. I grew up eating liver, and I swore I would never do that again.
But you see how brilliant you are? Your mother saved you. That's why they call you the brainiac.
Okay.
It's because your mother forced you to eat calf liver growing up.
Because it's cheap.
You know what I think the easy thing is? Now, I'm really not trying to make a joke by saying this, but if your wife were to take calf liver and just grind it up and add it to ground beef and make a meatloaf, what if
right.
she put in onions and peppers or whatever you like? You wouldn't even know it's in there.
Right, but isn't liver these days untrustworthy?
Tell me what your thought process is.
Oh, because of the chemicals and stuff in beef and...
Well, here's what I'm going to say, and I don't know if I can win with this one, but I'm going to try. Liver is the most incredible detoxifying organ system in the body, but it doesn't store toxins. It can't.
Oh.
Now, human beings try to make it store toxins, so... If somebody eats a very high carbohydrate meal over and over again, they don't get any exercise and they become very sluggish, then yeah, you can force the liver to store fat and you can develop, you know, cirrhosis of the liver and a fatty liver just because you overwhelm the body with too much sugar. You can do that.
Right.
But if you were to take a cow to the meat processing plant.
Right.
The liver is the very first organ. They have to clean it, wash it. But I think it's the hallmark or the bedrock of tremendous health. So if you want to have, you know, B1 is just one of the probably 48 or 49 B vitamins that are available. But you get B1 from liver. And you get the other, you probably get all of the other 48 B vitamins from liver also.
Okay.
That's why I use B vitamin supplements that come from calf liver extracts. But I think it's very safe.
Okay,
or
that
if
is...
if you don't eat liver, you can just develop Alzheimer's. That was a bad joke. I didn't mean it that
way. Right. All righty. Well, very good. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Just consider that. Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Oh, boy. That's got to be like a crazy idea, a little bit of calf liver. I actually took a handful of B vitamins this morning, and they were all based on calf liver. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
If you'll just turn that radio.
Yeah,
there you go.
Oh. Sorry about that. Jesus.
Yeah.
How do you spell that man's last name, Dr. Norman Doidge, is it?
Doidge. D-O-I-D-G-E, I think.
Okay.
And he's written a book called The Brain's Way of Healing. But the gentleman that called, he was wanting help specifically dealing with Parkinson's. And there's a chapter in that book that really goes into great detail that gives you something that's doable that's not based on a drug.
Okay.
Now, I've been doing this for almost 30 years now, and I have yet to see a drug work for Parkinson's.
Okay.
I wish I could.
And then Dale Bredesen,
that book is called The End of Alzheimer's, and I'm looking at it right now.
Okay.
Now, I haven't gone through the entire book. I've read exactly the preface, so... That's not going to sound real impressive to read 13 pages.
Okay.
But, you know, it's right up my alley. But I have flipped through each page of the book, just scanning it.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes through probably all 37 different possible reasons why a person would be predisposed. And he tackles each one of them, which I appreciate that. And so what if there's 37 common or studied reasons why a person could develop dementia or Alzheimer's?
Yeah.
And all we do... is cover one of them. What are the chances of success if you only get one of those right?
Mm-hmm. Well,
there's 36 you didn't get right. So mm-hmm. I appreciate his book so far for that. But, yes, I have it in my possession, and that's on my list to start pulverizing and pouring through the information.
Okay. And then for a lady, how would you raise the white blood count? Mine's gotten way low, 2.5.
Okay. Well, why
chronic low-grade infection?
Well, that's one thing you have to deal with. So you have to look at the teeth, the sinuses, the paranasal sinuses. You have to look at the tonsils. I would say the other common ones are going to be somewhere within the gut. Have you ever heard of diverticulitis or diverticulosis?
Yeah.
You ever heard of people having gallbladder problems?
Mm-hmm.
So unless if you've had some type of old injury where you've damaged a joint, sometimes I can see bone infections also. And trying to pinpoint where those are, but you kind of picked up on the sinuses, didn't you?
Yeah, sinuses, and I have had cancer 27 years ago, but that's where we found that it's got...
Well, and can I just oversimplify all this?
Okay.
If you have a white blood cell count at 2.5, that means your bone marrow and your stem cells, they're just tired. And so you got a combination here. You have the largest filter of your immune system is called the spleen.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got to believe that I'm giving you a gold mine of information. So if the spleen is the largest filter, and the spleen helps generate antibodies, and the spleen extracts used to be used to treat cancer 100 years ago, then I don't know that I'm ready to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but just think spleen.
Mm-hmm.
The largest gland of your immune system is called the thymus gland.
Mm-hmm.
Don't underestimate the thymus, because quite often the thymus is the key to restoring a white blood cell count. But historically, you're looking at an herb called astragalus. But you've got to resolve the chronic sinus problem. So I would rather promote all these different steps to healing. So when you go to a doctor, just ask them, where do you think my infection is, doctor, and what's your plan?
Mm-hmm.
What's your plan for restoring my white blood cell count? And just tell me what he says or she says.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for your call. Appreciate you.
Appreciate
Bye-bye.
You, too. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you'd like to join me on the radio, there's a phone line officially open at 903-586-5658. 503-586-5257. That's 903-586-5257. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Morgan.
Thanks for turning your radio down before you get on the air. I'm going to give you an A-plus for that one.
Well, good. Thank you. I called a couple weeks ago and had swelling in the leg. And you thought maybe it was kind of like dirty blood or thick blood.
Mm-hmm.
With swollen left ankle more so. And I went and had my blood done. And the hematocrit and hemoglobin are just a little bit high.
What do you mean a little bit high?
Just hematocrit 46.8.
Yeah, but see, that's very significant, though, because if you look at a hematocrit, and I'm just looking at the medical research, if that's at 41 to 42, there's very little risk of having a heart attack. But when you get to 46 to 48, you double your risk because your blood is thicker.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I didn't say that to bring you down. I was just trying to give you information.
So what's a good diet to, I know you said maybe fast one meal a day.
I tell you what, that right there is the, okay, I'm going to kind of be bold here and tell you what I think. If a person wants to have incredible rejuvenation, I'm going to tell you what happens with the blood. If you do not eat for 18 hours, so if there's 24 hours a day and you have somewhere between 18 to 20 hours where you're not consuming food, all of a sudden that your body focuses on cleaning the blood. And that may be done just every so often, but let's just say today that you choose not to eat breakfast or not to eat lunch and you're going to put everything off. What would happen to you if you tried to do some form of exercise and then you ate at, 5 o'clock this evening? You could almost eat as much food as you want. But your body would use all its energy instead of processing food and digesting food and tagging food for where it's going to go. That's got to be, fasting is absolutely the most rapid unburdening of the body of toxic debris and waste, and that's where I see it come out. But you would drink plenty of water. Now, if you told me that you were worried about your muscles because you're like very thin, then what you may do is you might have like some grass-fed whey protein a couple times a day, but that would have no sugar in it, just to feed and nourish your muscles. But you could also take lemon juice and water several times a day. You could do that.
Mm-hmm.
But this is probably just telling us the condition of your blood. So if your hematocrit is 46, what did you say the other number was?
15.9.
I mean, do you actually drink plenty of water, or are you a little bit dehydrated?
Probably a little dehydrated.
Then just give it a shot today. Drink a minimum of a half an ounce for every pound that you weigh. So if you weigh 120 pounds, that's 60 ounces of water a day.
Okay.
And just see what happens. And you may notice a rapid change. I almost wish we could test your blood tomorrow morning,
mm-hmm,
after a day of fasting and drinking plenty of water.
Okay. Great. Okay. And then it showed up also a little low on the white blood count.
Yeah, and I don't like that, because that means the person is losing the strength of their immune system, and I want you to be radiant and strong. And so if the white blood cell count, like I told the gentleman earlier, if it comes in at 5.6 or below, then I have no choice. I've got to consider some type of a low-grade chronic infection. And the usual culprits are going to be either the teeth or the sinuses or the tonsils or the gallbladder, or some type of infection in the gut. Unless somebody's had like a major, you know, hip replacement, knee replacement, then you can find like chronic infections around those guys.
Okay. And if the doctor wanted to refer to a vascular clinic.
For what's a vascular clinic for?
Well, for the leg swelling. Or maybe insufficient venous return?
Well, can I say it this way? And I know this is just a tremendous simple idea. So one of the things that I'm after is I like testing people. So what would happen if we actually took a tape measure and we measured the circumference of your left ankle compared with the right ankle?
Mm-hmm.
Then we measure the circumference of the mid part of your calf, or I should just say, you know where the calf muscle is, don't you, in your lower leg?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if we just went mid-calf at its widest circumference and measured that, then it's fine with me if you measured just slightly above the knee with the leg straight and then probably mid-thigh and then hips. And I would say those would be 3, 4, 5 accurate measurements for your leg, and you can compare right to left. And so if they want to send you to a vascular clinic, I'm just going to say, what if we tried this whole deal a different way? What if you tried just drinking water so we can kind of dilute the blood? Because right now, at 15.9, your hemoglobin, and 46, did you say 46.2?
46.8.
Oh, 46.8 on the hematocrit. At the very least, I mean, just from those numbers right there, the blood is just too thick and too dirty. Now, personally, I am a fan of B vitamins because I don't know that you want me going into all the details, but if you lack B vitamins, your blood's just going to be thick and dirty. That's all there is to it.
Is it B or B?
B as in boy.
You know what? I took extra B vitamins about 4 days before this blood test because I thought, well, I wanted to maybe like a natural diuretic.
Did it work?
So, well, he took the B vitamin, and it was actually flagged as high. It was over 2,000.
Well, that's not B vitamins. That's one B vitamin. That's vitamin B12.
Right.
And what that really means is, and I'm going to give you a completely different story than what they gave you, okay?
Okay.
B12 is by far and away the most complex. It's the largest B vitamin. It's the hardest one to break down, absorb, and assimilate because it's bound to a trace element called cobalt, and it's bound to protein. So there's not really any source of B12 in nature when it comes to plants. It just doesn't happen. You can eat all the celery you want. I'm just real sorry, but there's no B12. B12, like I told the gentleman earlier, that would be found in high concentrations in calf liver.
Mm-hmm.
And so B12 requires about maybe 8 precise steps, like one domino has to fall, then the other one has to fall just to get B12 in the body. So if your B12 is above 2,000, what that means is, oh yeah, you've got B12, but you ain't absorbing any bit of it, not any of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's there, but your body's just not able to utilize it. So wouldn't that be something if you were severely dehydrated and thirsty and there was water all around you, but because you were tied to a tree, you couldn't drink from the barrel of water that's just 2 inches in front of you because you couldn't reach it? So you've got plenty of B12, but your body enzymatically cannot split and break those chemical bonds where it can actually use it. So that's another very, very powerful clue that you have right there. And so we got to see how this plays out, we got to turn all this around. And so what I would question is there any chance that you're eating any foods that might generate inflammation in the lower part of the gut that keeps you from absorbing and utilizing B12? The number one food I know of has got to be wheat.
A little bit.
Now, I read the article earlier. Anytime you consume carbohydrates, your body requires vitamin B1 and B12 to process it. So some people, they eat in such a way, not you, some other people, they eat in such a way where they deplete their bodies of vitamins, or they have a lifetime of stress and infections and issues. There's lots of reasons why you could have these problems. So it's just a matter of trying to correct them one by one.
Okay. Cool. One more question. Like, is there a clot-busting diet?
A clot-busting diet?
Yeah, blood clot-busting diet.
Yeah, you can, yeah. I would say a ketogenic diet could probably do that very, very effectively because I've seen that work over and over again. What do you think I do when I have somebody walk in the office and they say, Dr. Morgan, I've got 4 clots. They've tried using these drugs. I can't tolerate the drugs because they're killing me. is there any way to get rid of these clots? And I say, yeah, but all you got to do is just go back to the doctor, let them scan you for the clots, and they come back in a few weeks and go, guess what, Dr. Morgan? All the clots are mysteriously gone. It's the doctor doesn't even know how, because usually what they say is they go, well, looky there. It looks like the warfarin, Coumadin, Plavix, Xarelto, the rest of them just work like a champ. And the lady goes, there's only one problem. I never took those drugs because I couldn't tolerate them. But Hawthorn is the herb that will just totally dissolve all the clots. Enzymes can dissolve clots. But see, if you start a process of exercising and you grow 1 pound of new muscle, guess what happens if you grow a pound of muscle in your left leg? You effectively grow brand new arteries to fuel the muscle, brand new veins. So it's the job of your heart to pump blood down to your toes. It's a job of your muscles and their tone and their efficiency and all of your legs to pull it right back. So it's your muscles that push venous blood back, not the heart. So if you have venous insufficiency, that's a muscle problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So get your muscles in good repair and you won't have this problem.
Great.
Unless you're taking a drug called a statin. Because I see people, anything that's hard on the liver is going to cause the left leg to swell.
Mm-mm.
Or if the liver's clogged up. I did a gallbladder flush one time, not that long ago. I think I had 37 stones come out.
Oh my gosh.
So, you can find out for yourself what you want to do, but usually anything that affects the liver adversely is going to cause the left leg to swell. As one idea. It's not the only one, but it's one.
Much.
You're welcome. I hope that helps you a whole bunch.
Oh, it will. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And the thing of it is, it's not hard to grow muscle. All you have to do is you have to flip the right sequence of hormonal switches and responses under the right circumstances. It just takes about 15 minutes a week of exercise. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm doing well. I got a question about what would be a reason to, I stay tired all the time. I can get plenty of sleep, and I still wake up, and maybe I might be good for about an hour or so, but then I'm tired all over again.
Do you get your second wind around 5 or 6 in the evening? Do you start to feel like you're getting your energy back around that time?
Yep, the main reason is I work in the evening. I work the night shift, so I'm kind of going.
Oh boy! Well then, let me tell you what I would consider. And I'm just going to cover some. I'll cover some information. I'm not trying to say it precisely. Has you to a T, but your body is supposed to make what's called vitamin D3, and it does so when you're in contact with the sunlight.
Yep.
And so that's probably the only time of the day that you have a chance to sleep, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the two most common symptoms of a severe vitamin D deficiency would be fatigue that just never, ever seems to resolve itself, and you got some type of ache or pain that just won't go away.
Mm-hmm.
And another way of turning that around is vitamin D is essential for a lot of body processes and functions. And so if you have a lack of that, there'll be a lot of things that go undone, so fatigue is just one of them. So consider that because of your schedule. Number two, if we were to look at how your body produces energy, they usually call that the Krebs cycle or the citric acid cycle. Sometimes it's called the Cori cycle. But to make a long story short, you don't even know how many B vitamins you got to have just to produce energy within your mitochondria or in your cells.
Yeah.
And so I'd say B vitamins are always one of the things that I might consider and I might look at. So if a person wakes up in, well, I started to say the morning, I should
in
say
the evening.
For you, if you wake up and you're still tired, I think I slept, but I don't feel like I'm totally refreshed where I feel just fabulous,
Correct. That
would be a classic B vitamin deficiency, or that'd be a sign of a B vitamin deficiency.
Yeah.
The other thing that I would look at, there is a gland that sits just atop of your kidneys. It's called the adrenal gland. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you right now, a human being's fortunes are going to rise or fall based on how well the adrenal glands are working. I don't even know how many thousands of cases I've seen like this, but I bet you anything, your adrenal glands are just about at the end of themselves, and they're just probably exhausted.
Yeah.
So I would ask you just for kicks, try taking vitamin D3. See what happens.
Vitamin B3?
D as in David.
Oh, vitamin
Sorry.
D.
Yeah, D as in David, okay. And then the number 3. That's the active form of vitamin D. Mm-hmm. And then you might look for just natural B vitamin complex, and it'll tell you if it's natural. It'll say it comes from liver and from animal parts, things like that. But take those. There's no harm that can come to you. It's just a water-soluble vitamin. If your body can't use it, it'll kick it out. Now, if you take a synthetic B vitamin, oh, my word, that's going to make your urine fluorescent orange. I mean, yellow.
Oh, yeah. Yellow, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That's because your body tries to kick it out. It's a stimulant. So you could take that, and if you wanted just perchance to go to the store and take some type of an adrenal support supplement, you could take that and tell me if all of a sudden you start to see a change in how your body's functioning and feeling.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But I can tell you this, any time in a man that you have some of these things going on, see, you got to have some vitamin D to make what's called testosterone.
Yeah.
And usually when a man has plenty of testosterone, he's got plenty of energy, he's got tremendous motivation, he's got drive, ambition, he's got things that he wants to do, and he just feels good and calmer when he's got plenty of growth hormone and testosterone. So when those are low, oh my goodness, your energy production is going to really suffer, and I want you to be very energetic so you can really divide and conquer your universe.
Yeah, correct.
So just try those things. Let me know what happens.
I have a problem with my memory, like my short-term memory. Would all this have to do with that?
Yeah, and that's the very reason why I covered that article this morning about Alzheimer's disease and vitamin B1 was because the more carbohydrates or sugar a person consumes, so whether it's grains or starches or fruits or sugar, that depletes the body of B1. So this one study from Asia, all they did was they gave the fat-soluble form of vitamin B1 to people for 18 months, and it caused a 37% reclaiming of dead brain tissue, basically. Very, very impressive. I've never seen a drug do that. Believe me, if they had a drug they could reactivate 37% of the brain, are you kidding me?
Yes.
They would be screaming from the top of the mountain, and the people would say, please, let me buy it. I'll give you $800,000 for that. But it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. But B1 did it.
Yeah.
Just incredible. Of course, probably takes a slightly crazy person like me willing to say something like that.
Yeah.
But so, and I want your mind to work better. So.
Oh, yeah. So the D3 and natural vitamin B what?
Well, just get the B vitamin complex. There's 48 B vitamins. If you get something that's based on calf liver or other animal organs, it's going to have all of them in there. That's just as simple as that.
Yeah, because I guess the other one, like you said, the synthetic, is what causes your urine to turn yellow.
Totally, you're correct. I think you've got that part mastered, don't you?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I got plenty of experience with that.
Yeah, but I want you to have a sharp mind where you could use your energy serving your family and your fellow man and God.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yes, sir.
Good deal.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thank you for your phone call. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, the number here at the station is 903-586-5257. 903-586-5257. All right. If no one calls for a question, here's a phone call, but there's an article. I don't know how disturbed I am by it. I'm slightly disturbed. Good morning. Welcome to the program. Thanks for your call.
Yes, sir. I've got a question about the gallbladder flush. I went to the doctor, and he said I need to have my gallbladder removed, but he said there's nothing wrong with my gallbladder. I just got gallstones.
Yeah.
And I was wanting to know if you knew if that and what entails, you know, what do you do?
Did he tell you that your gallstone was the size of a 57 Buick?
Yeah, basically, they're pretty big. It's pretty big.
Well, did he say that, is that the only option he's giving you, just to surgically remove it?
That's the only option he gave me. I asked him about the flush, about, you know, trying to get that. He said all that, the all-natural flush, you know, where you take the apple juice for like 4 or 5 days, and then you take a little bit of the Epsom salt.
Yeah.
Have you heard about that flush?
Yeah, what did he say about that?
He said all that won't work.
Oh, well, my goodness, why would you even waste your time asking me about that then? I'll just waste your time trying to convince you otherwise. No, I mean, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. Whether it's true or not is two different things. I know this is kind of maddening. Now, I don't have your test results in front of me, but I can tell you there's some things that I would consider thoughtfully and prayerfully. Number one, if the only option he's given you, he just has in his mind he wants to go ahead and remove the gallbladder, but he hasn't told you about the long-term consequences of having your gallbladder removed. And
no.
What the complications could be. So you could always ask him that if he wants to volunteer that information, or just look it up for yourself since you're pretty studious.
Okay.
If there are large stones, one of the things that I'll attempt to do, I'll try to convince a person that they need the juice of one lemon, probably about 3 or 4 times a day, in a glass of water. And I know it sounds nuts, but you listen, I believe in it because I see it work over and over again. The lemon juice will act as a solvent. The word solvent is almost like you put your dirty blue jeans in the washing machine and you add hot water.
How about lemon juice? How about lemon juice that comes in, you know, you can buy the lemon
juice.
I
haven't found that really as effective as a real lemon.
Okay.
They add a lot of salt. Yep, that's it.
Yep. Okay. Put it in water.
That's right. That's all you do is, you want to squeeze it first.
Squeeze it into a glass of water.
Squeeze it into a glass of water. Whatever size water you like is going to be perfectly fine.
Okay.
The other thing that I like is I love the idea of beets, because beets are very high in betaine, so there's a lot of ways to do this. You could take like one small beet. You could pulverize it in a blender with a little bit of water and drink it down. If you want to put a spoonful of lemon juice and a spoonful of extra virgin olive oil into it, all the better. But you're trying to slowly break down this debris or the sludge in your gallbladder. Lemon juice. And a lot of times, you know, I can't even tell you how many people that I've seen. And this is just my interpretation, so take it all with a grain of salt. When I examine a person, I will take my fingers and I will push just below the right upper quadrant of their, or the edge of their rib cage, into their tummy, and I'll push into what I would call the common bile duct. And if the bile duct feels fine, I always think that they've got all systems go and they're clear for a gallbladder flush. And I just think it's going to be easy. If the gallbladder is, if the bile duct is really inflamed, I do everything I can to talk them out of doing a gallbladder flush, because if it's swollen and inflamed, that's just not the right circumstance to pass all those gallstones. I usually will work on trying to heal that and calm that down first, and there's a lot of stuff I just can't even cover because of time this morning. But if you want to look up a gallbladder flush on YouTube, look it up and tell me what you think about it. I mean, on many levels, they can be incredible, but I'm telling you my honest opinion, I do not recommend a gallbladder flush if the bile duct is swollen and inflamed.
Well, how do you know if that bile duct is swollen and inflamed?
Well, I just told you, I press into it to see if it's if a person screams, I know it's inflamed.
Well, I don't have any problem there, I don't think.
Well, you don't know that though. You're making a whole bunch of assumptions.
Okay.
Well, I just know that from doing this for 30 years. If you were here in front of me, I say, lay on this floor. It's nice KBJS linoleum tile. And then I could press into your bile duct. And if I tell you what, I can never feel them unless they're swollen and inflamed. But if it's swollen, that's not the right circumstance to do a gallbladder flush. So we usually try to calm it down. And, yes, I've had a few cases that it took a couple of months of good, consistent effort to get that calmed down to where we could do a gallbladder flush. But I've also had plenty of people, and this is what I was alluding to, just with the lemon juice and the beets, just all the gallstones just came out without even doing a flush. And so that requires you looking at the potty. So if you go to the bathroom and it's like rocks are coming out of your bottom, that may not be the
right thing.
Okay,
how many days you need to do that?
Well, I don't know what the condition of your body is.
My body's in good shape.
Yeah, you're in good shape, so you have a gallbladder full of gallstones. Okay, I got it. So,
well, besides that, I'm in good shape.
Well, if you say so. And so, for example, I had a lady one time. All she did was that little formula I just told you about. And after about 2 months, all the gallstones just came out on their own without any flushing whatsoever. So, okay. I mean, all these things are just relative, and it just depends. If you're super strong and healthy, why hasn't your body kicked out the gallstones before now? I don't know. I have a whole bunch of ideas. Well, I've got a bunch of ideas, but I'm not going to cover them just because we don't have time.
I got you.
But I would say if you would do yourself a favor, maybe you could take about 2 or 3 cups of dandelion tea a day. You can work on the lemon juice. You can take the juice of one beet, maybe add a little bit of lemon juice to it, water, a little bit of olive oil. Drink it every day. See if we can't soften and loosen these stones where they'll just come out and pass on their own. Because to me, that is a win. So if you were to go back to the doctor and they did another scan before your gallbladder surgery and say, oh, well, that's weird. All your gallstones are gone. I guess we should keep it.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty funny. But the least, I would say the typical American diet that's low fat and high in sugar is just a recipe for growing gallstones.
Yeah. Okay, got you.
But you don't eat that way anyway, do you? Never mind. We don't have to cover that topic.
Yeah, I've been doing better. But listen, I appreciate the information.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right, God bless you. You have a good day.
God bless you too. I wish you the very best. Let me know how it works out.
Okay, I will. Bye bye.
I know that doesn't make sense to everybody, but yes, I have spent much energy trying to convince people. Do not. I know you want to do a gallbladder flush today. Don't do it. Your gallbladder is too inflamed. Your bile duct is too inflamed. So sometimes you just have to take a step back. You have to work on trying to calm down and soothe the gallbladder and the bile duct and let it heal. And in the meantime, if your own body is able to softly, gently, easily, quietly dissolve stones and they can pass without any rigmarole or bad symptoms, wouldn't you say that would be a win? Oh, my word, yes. Well, all you can do is try. If you want to join me on the radio, oh my goodness, we're just about out of time. Sorry about that. Okay, do I even have enough time for another phone call? Probably not. Anyway, let me talk about a few things. If you told me that every time you wake up in the morning that you just do not feel as rested as you should be, you might want to consider that your liver is sluggish. Or another simple thing to think of is, if you have made every effort to either gain weight or, probably more commonly, to lose weight, but your body won't budge, then I have no choice but to just assume, could be wrong about this, but I just have to assume that your liver's clogged up. And it probably has plenty of gallstones in there. Now, I realize there's several gallbladder surgeons listening right now that are shaking their finger at the radio, disagreeing with me. Listen, if you want to have a gallbladder surgery, fine by me. Go have it today. This is your choice. You may wish you hadn't had it. You might wish that you'd kept all your original working organs if you knew that it was within the power to do so. So, I vote we keep your gallbladder. But in today's culture, the gallbladder is so overworked. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, make it easy on your body to heal. This program is Health Essentials. I'm your host, Dr. Roy Morgan. And you're listening to KBJS FM 90.3, Jacksonville, Tyler, and Longview.